This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Firestarter, a novel by Stephen King. Read by Dennis Boutsakaris.
In memory of Shirley Jackson, who never needed to raise her voice. It was a pleasure to burn. Ray Bradbury, Fahrenheit 451. New York, Albany. 1.
Daddy, I'm tired, the little girl in the red pants and the green blouse said fretfully. Can't we stop?
Not yet, honey. He was a big, broad-shouldered man in a worn and scuffed corduroy jacket and plain brown twill slacks. He and the little girl were holding hands and walking up Third Avenue in New York City, walking fast, almost running. He looked back over his shoulder and the green car was still there, crawling along slowly in the curbside lane.
Please, Daddy, please.
He looked at her and saw how pale her face was. There were dark circles under her eyes. He picked her up and sat her in the crook of his arm, but he didn't know how long he could go on like that. He was tired, too, and Charlie was no lightweight anymore. It was 5:30 in the afternoon, and Third Avenue was clogged. They were crossing streets in the upper 60s now, and these cross streets were both darker and less populated, but that was what he was afraid of. They bumped into a lady pushing a walker full of groceries.
"Look where you're going, won't you?"
she said, and was gone, swallowed in the hurrying crowds. His arm was getting tired, and he switched Charlie to the other one. He snatched another look behind, and the green car was still there, still pacing them, about half a block behind. There were two men in the front seat, and he thought a third in the back. What do I do now? He didn't know the answer to that. He was tired and scared, and it was hard to think. They had caught him at a bad time, and the bastards probably knew it. What he wanted to do was just sit down on the dirty curbing and cry out his frustration and fear. But that was no answer. He was the grown-up. He would have to think for both of them. What do we do now? No money. That was maybe the biggest problem after the fact of the men in the green car. You couldn't do anything with no money in New York. People with no money disappeared in New York. They dropped into the sidewalks, never to be seen again. He looked back over his shoulder, saw the green car was a little closer, and the sweat began to run down his back and his arms a little faster. If they knew as much as he suspected they did, if they knew how little of the push he actually had left, they might try to take him right here and now. Never mind all the people, either. In New York, if it's not happening to you, you develop this funny blindness. Have they been charting me? Andy wondered desperately. If they have, they know, and it's all over but the shouting. If they had, they knew the pattern. After Andy got some money, the strange things stopped happening for a while. The things they were interested in.
Keep walking. Sure, boss. Yes, sir, boss. Where?
He had gone into the bank at noon because his radar had been alerted, that funny hunch that they were getting close again. There was money in the bank, and he and Charlie could run on it if they had to. And wasn't that funny? Andrew McGee no longer had an account at the Chemical Allied Bank of New York. Not personal checking, not business checking, not savings. They had all disappeared into thin air. And that was when he knew they really meant to bring the hammer down this time. Had all of that really been only 5.5 hours ago? But maybe there was a tickle left, just one little tickle. It had been nearly a week since the last time. That pre-suicidal man at Confidence Associates, who had come to the regular Thursday night counseling session and then begun to talk with an eerie calmness about how Hemingway had committed suicide. And on the way out, his arm casually around the pre-suicidal man's shoulders, Andy had given him a push. Now, bitterly, he hoped it had been worth it, because it looked very much as if he and Charlie were going to be the ones to pay. He almost hoped an echo, but no, he pushed that away, horrified and disgusted with himself. That was nothing to wish on anybody. One little tickle, he prayed. That's all. God, just one little tickle. Enough to get me and Charlie out of this jam. And oh, God, how you'll pay. Plus the fact that you'll be dead for a month afterward, just like a radio with a blown tube. Maybe 6 weeks, or maybe really dead with your worthless brains leaking out your ears. What would happen to Charlie then? They were coming up on 70th Street, and the light was against them. Traffic was pouring across, and pedestrians were building up at the corner in a bottleneck. And suddenly he knew this was where the men in the green car would take them.
Alive if they could, of course, but if it looked like trouble, well, they had probably been briefed on Charlie, too. Maybe they don't even want us alive anymore. Maybe they've decided just to maintain the status quo.
What do you do with a faulty equation?
Erase it from the board. A knife in the back. A silenced pistol. Quite possibly something more arcane. A drop of rare poison on the end of a needle. Convulsions at the corner of 3rd and 70th, officer. This man appears to have suffered a heart attack.
He would have to try for that tickle. There was just nothing else.
They reached the waiting pedestrians at the corner. Across the way, "Don't Walk" held steady and seemingly eternal. He looked back. The green car had stopped. The curbside doors opened and two men in business suits got out. They were young and smooth-cheeked. They looked considerably fresher than Andy McGee felt. He began elbowing his way through the clog of pedestrians, eyes searching frantically for a vacant cab.
"Hey, man. For Christ's sake, fella. Please, mister, you're stepping on my dog."
"Excuse me, excuse me," Andy said desperately. He searched for a cab. There were none. At any other time, the street would have been stuffed with them.
He could feel the men from the green car coming for them, wanting to lay hands on him and Charlie,
to take them with them God knew where, the shop, some damn place, or do something even worse. Charlie laid her head on his shoulder and yawned. Andy saw a vacant cab.
"Taxi, taxi,"
he yelled, flagging madly with his free hand. Behind him, the two men dropped all pretense and ran. The taxi pulled over.
"Hold it," one of the men yelled. "Police, police."
A woman near the back of the crowd at the corner screamed, and then they all began to scatter. Andy opened the cab's back door and handed Charlie in. He dived in after her.
"LaGuardia, step on it," he said. "Hold it, cabbie, police."
The cab driver turned his head toward the voice, and Andy pushed very gently. A dagger of pain was planted squarely in the center of Andy's forehead, and then quickly withdrawn, leaving a vague locus of pain, like a morning headache, the kind you get from sleeping on your neck.
"They're after that black guy in the checkered cap, I think," he said to the cabbie.
"Right,"
the driver said, and pulled serenely away from the curb. They moved down East 70th. Andy looked back. The two men were standing alone at the curb. The rest of the pedestrians wanted nothing to do with them. One of the men took a walkie-talkie from his belt and began to speak into it. Then they were gone.
"The black guy," the driver said. "What'd he do? Rob a liquor store or something, you think?"
"I don't know," Andy said, trying to think how to go on with this, how to get the most out of this cab driver for the least push. Had they got the cab's plate number? He would have to assume they had, but they wouldn't want to go to the city or state cops, and they would be surprised and scrambling, for a while at least.
"They're all a bunch of junkies, the blacks in this city," the driver said. "Don't tell me, I'll tell you."
Charlie was going to sleep. Andy took off his corduroy jacket, folded it, and slipped it under her head. He had begun to feel a thin hope. If he could play this right, it might work. Lady Luck had sent him what Andy thought of, with no prejudice at all, as a pushover. He was the sort that seemed the easiest to push. Right down the line, he was white. Orientals were the toughest, for some reason. He was quite young. Old people were nearly impossible, and of medium intelligence. Bright people were the easiest pushes, stupid ones harder, and with the mentally retarded, it was impossible.
"I've changed my mind," Andy said. "Take us to Albany, please."
"Where?"
The driver stared at him in the rearview mirror.
"Man, I can't take a fare to Albany. You out of your mind?"
Andy pulled his wallet, which contained a single-dollar bill. He thanked God that this was not one of those cabs with a bulletproof partition and no way to contact the driver except through a money slot. Open contact always made it easier to push. He had been unable to figure out if that was a psychological thing or not, and right now it was immaterial.
"I'm going to give you a $500 bill," Andy said quietly, "to take me and my daughter to Albany. Okay?"
"Jesus, mister..."
Andy stuck the bill into the cabbie's hand, and as the cabbie looked down at it, Andy pushed, and pushed hard. For a terrible second, he was afraid it wasn't going to work, that there was simply nothing left, that he had scraped the bottom of the barrel when he had made the driver see the non-existent black man in the checkered cab. Then the feeling came, as always accompanied by that steel dagger of pain. At the same moment, his stomach seemed to take on weight and his bowels locked in sick, gripping agony. He put an unsteady hand to his face and wondered if he was going to throw up or die. For that one moment, he wanted to die, as he always did when he overused it. "Use it. Don't abuse it," the sign-off slogan of some long-ago disc jockey echoing sickly in his mind, whatever it was, if at that very moment someone had slipped a gun into his hand. Then he looked sideways at Charlie. Charlie sleeping, Charlie trusting him to get them out of this mess as he had all the others. Charlie confident he would be there when she woke up. Yes, all the messes, except it was all the same mess, the same fucking mess, and all they were doing was running again. Black despair pressed behind his eyes. The feeling passed, but not the headache. The headache would get worse and worse until it was a smashing weight, sending red pain through his head and neck with every pulse beat. Bright lights would make his eyes water helplessly and send darts of agony into the flesh just behind his eyes. His sinuses would close, and he would have to breathe through his mouth. Drill bits in his temples, small noises magnified, ordinary noises as loud as jackhammers, loud noises insupportable. The headache would worsen until it felt as if his head were being crushed inside an Inquisitor's love cap. Then it would even off at that level for 6 hours, or 8, or maybe 10. This time he didn't know. He had never pushed it so far when he was so close to drained. For whatever length of time he was in the grip of the headache, he would be next to helpless. Charlie would have to take care of him. God knew she had done it before, but they had been lucky. How many times could you be lucky?
Gee, mister, I don't know.
Which meant he thought it was law trouble. The deal only goes as long as you don't mention it to my little girl, Andy said. The last 2 weeks she's been with me has to be back with her mother tomorrow morning.
Visitation rights? The cabbie said. I know all about it.
You see, I was supposed to fly her up.
To Albany?
Probably Ozark, am I right?
Right. Now, the thing is, I'm scared to death of flying. I know how crazy that sounds, but it's true. Usually I drive her back up, but this time my ex-wife started in on me and, I don't know.
In truth, Andy didn't. He had made up the story on the spur of the moment, and now it seemed to be headed straight down a blind alley. Most of it was pure exhaustion.
So I drop you at the old Albany airport, and as far as Mom's knows, you flew, right?
Sure. His head was thudding.
Also, as far as Mom's knows, you're no plucka-plucka-plucka, am I 4-0?
Yes. Plucka-plucka-plucka, what was that supposed to mean? The pain was getting bad.
$500 to skip a plane ride, the driver mused.
It's worth it to me, Andy said, and gave one last little shove. In a very quiet voice, speaking almost into the cabbie's ear, he added, and it ought to be worth it to you.
Listen, the driver said in a dreamy voice, I ain't turning down no $500. Don't tell me, I'll tell you.
Okay, Andy said, and settled back. The cab driver was satisfied. He wasn't wondering about Andy's half-baked story. He wasn't wondering what a 7-year-old girl was doing visiting her father for 2 weeks in October with school in. He wasn't wondering about the fact that neither of them had so much as an overnight bag. He wasn't worried about anything. He had been pushed. Now Andy would go ahead and pay the price. He put a hand on Charlie's leg. She was fast asleep. They had been on the go all afternoon, ever since Andy got to her school and pulled her out of her second-grade class with some half-remembered excuse. Grandmother's very ill, called home, sorry to have to take her in the middle of the day. And beneath all that, a great swelling relief. How he had dreaded looking into Mrs. Mishkin's room and seeing Charlie's seat empty, her books stacked neatly inside her desk.
No, Mr. McGee, she went with your friends about 2 hours ago. They had a note from you. Wasn't that all right?
Memories of Vicky coming back, the sudden terror of the empty house that day. His crazy chase after Charlie, because they had had her once before. Oh, yes. But Charlie had been there. How close had it been? Had he beaten them by 30 minutes, 15 minutes, less? He didn't like to think about it. He had got them a late lunch at Nathan's, and they had spent the rest of the afternoon just going. Andy could admit to himself now that he had been in a state of blind panic, riding subways, buses, but mostly just walking. And now she was worn out. He spared her a long, loving look. Her hair was shoulder-length, perfect blonde, and in her sleep she had a calm beauty. She looked so much like Vicky that it hurt. He closed his own eyes. In the front seat, the cab driver looked wonderingly at the $500 bill the guy had handed him. He tucked it away in the special belt pocket where he kept all of his tips. He didn't think it was strange that this fellow in the back had been walking around New York with a little girl and a $500 bill in his pocket.
He didn't wonder how he was going to square this with his dispatcher. All he thought of was how excited his girlfriend Glynn was going to be. Glynnis kept telling him that driving a taxi was a dismal, unexciting job. Well, wait until she saw his dismal, unexciting $500 bill. In the back seat, Andy sat with his head back and his eyes closed. The headache was coming, coming, as inexorable as a riderless black horse in a funeral cortege. He could hear the hoofbeats of that horse in his temples. Thud, thud, thud. On the run, he and Charlie. He was 34 years old, and until last year he had been an instructor of English at Harrison State College in Ohio. Harrison was a sleepy little college town. Good old Harrison, the very heart of mid-America. Good old Andrew McGee, fine, upstanding young man. Remember the riddle, why is a farmer the pillar of his community? Because he's always outstanding in his field. Thud, thud, thud. Riderless black horse with red eyes coming down the halls of his mind. Iron-shod hooves digging up soft gray clods of brain tissue, leaving hoof prints to fill up with mystic crescents of blood. The cabbie had been a pushover, sure, an outstanding cab driver. He dozed and saw Charlie's face, and Charlie's face became Vicky's face. Andy McGee and his wife, Pretty Vicky, they had pulled her fingernails out one by one. They had pulled out four of them, and then she had talked. That, at least, was his deduction. Thumb, index, second, ring, then, stop, I'll talk, I'll tell you anything you want to know, just stop the hurting, please. So she had told, and then, perhaps it had been an accident. Then his wife had died. Well, some things are bigger than both of us, and other things are bigger than all of us. Things like the shop, for instance. Thud, thud, thud. Riderless black horse coming on, coming on. And coming on, behold, a black horse. And he slept, and remembered.
Two. The man in charge of the experiment was Dr. Wanless. He was fat and balding and had at least one rather bizarre habit.
"We're going to give each of you 12 young ladies and gentlemen an injection," he said, shredding a cigarette into the ashtray in front of him.
His small pink fingers plucked at the thin cigarette paper, spilling out neat little cones of golden-brown tobacco.
"Six of these injections will be water. Six of them will be water mixed with a tiny amount of a chemical compound which we call Lot 6. The exact nature of this compound is classified, but it is essentially an hypnotic and mild hallucinogenic. Thus, you understand that the compound will be administered by the double-blind method, which is to say, neither you nor we will know who has gotten a clear dose and who has not until later. The dozen of you will be under close supervision for 48 hours following the injection. Questions?"
There were several, most having to do with the exact composition of Lot 6. That word classified was like putting bloodhounds on a convict's trail. Wanless slipped these questions quite adroitly. No one had asked the question 22-year-old Andy McGee was most interested in. He considered raising his hand in the hiatus that fell upon the nearly deserted lecture hall in Harrison's combined psychology-sociology building and asking, "Say, why are you ripping up perfectly good cigarettes like that?" Better not to. Better to let the imagination run on a free rein while this boredom went on. He was trying to give up smoking. The oral retentive smokes them. The anal retentive shreds them. This brought a slight grin to Andy's lips, which he covered with a hand. Wanless's brother had died of lung cancer, and the doctor was symbolically venting his aggressions on the cigarette industry.
Or maybe it was just one of those flamboyant tics that college professors felt compelled to flaunt rather than suppress.
Andy had one English teacher his sophomore year at Harrison, the man was now mercifully retired, who sniffed his tie constantly while lecturing on William Dean Howells and the rise of realism.
"If there are no more questions, I'll ask you to fill out these forms, and we'll expect to see you promptly at 9 next Tuesday."
Two grad assistants passed out photocopies with 25 ridiculous questions to answer yes or no.
Number 8. Have you ever undergone psychiatric counseling?
Number 14.
Do you believe you have ever had an authentic psychic experience?
Number 18. Have you ever used hallucinogenic drugs? After a slight pause, Andy checked no to that one, thinking, in this brave year, 1969, who hasn't used them? He had been put onto this by Quincy Tremont, the fellow he had roomed with in college. Quincy knew that Andy's financial situation wasn't so hot. It was May of Andy's senior year. He was graduating 40th in a class of 506, third in the English program. But that didn't buy no potatoes, as he had told Quincy, who was a psych major. Andy had a GA lined up for himself starting in the fall semester, along with a scholarship loan package that would be just about enough to buy groceries and keep him in the Harrison grad program. But all of that was fall, and in the meantime, there was the summer hiatus. The best he had been able to line up so far was a responsible, challenging position as an ARCO gas jockey on the night shift. "How would you feel about a quick 200?" Quincy had asked. Andy brushed long, dark hair away from his green eyes and grinned. "Which men's room do I set up my concession in?" "No, it's a psych experiment," Quincy said. "Being run by the mad doctor, though, be warned."
"Who he?" "Him wanless, tonto. Heap big medicine man in psych department."
"Why do they call him the mad doctor?"
"Well," Quincy said, "he's a rat man and a Skinner man both, a behaviorist. The behaviorists are not exactly being overwhelmed with love these days."
"Oh," Andy said, mystified. "Also, he wears very thick little rimless glasses, which makes him look quite a bit like the guy that shrank the people in Dr. Cyclops. You ever see that show?" Andy, who was a late-show addict, had seen it and felt on safer ground, but he wasn't sure he wanted to participate in any experiments run by a prof who was classified as A, a rat man, and B, a mad doctor. "They're not trying to shrink people, are they?" he asked. Quincy had laughed heartily. "No, that's strictly for the special effects people who work on the B-horror pictures," he said. "The psych department has been testing a series of low-grade hallucinogens. They're working with the U.S. Intelligence Service."
"CIA?" Andy asked.
"Not CIA, DIA, or NSA," Quincy said. "Lower profile than any of them. Have you ever heard of an outfit called The Shop?"
"Maybe in a Sunday supplement or something. I'm not sure."
Quincy lit his pipe. "These things work in about the same way all across the board," he said. "Psychology, chemistry, physics, biology. Even the sociology boys get some of the folding green. Certain programs are subsidized by the government, anything from the mating ritual of the tsetse fly to the possible disposal of used plutonium slugs. An outfit like The Shop has to spend all of its yearly budget to justify a like amount the following year." "That shit troubles me mightily," Andy said.
"It troubles almost any thinking person," Quincy said with a calm, untroubled smile.
"But the train just keeps rolling. What does our intelligence branch want with low-grade hallucinogens? Who knows? Not me, not you. Probably they don't either, but the reports look good in closed committees come budget renewal time. They have their pets in every department. At Harrison, Wanless is their pet in the psych department."
"The administration doesn't mind?"
"Don't be naive, my boy."
He had his pipe going to his satisfaction and was puffing great stinking clouds of smoke out into the ratty apartment living room. His voice accordingly became more rolling, more orotund, more Buckley-esque. "What's good for Wanless is good for the Harrison Psychology Department, which next year will have its very own building, no more slumming with those sociology types. And what's good for psych is good for Harrison State College, and for Ohio, and all that blah blah."
"Do you think it's safe?"
"They don't test it on student volunteers if it isn't safe," Quincy said.
"If they have even the slightest question, they test it on rats and then on convicts. You can be sure that what they're putting into you has been put into roughly 300 people before you, whose reactions have been carefully monitored."
"I don't like this business about the CIA.
The Shop.
What's the difference?" Andy asked morosely. He looked at Quincy's poster of Richard Nixon standing in front of a crunched-up used car. Nixon was grinning, and a stubby V for victory poked up out of each clenched fist. Andy could still hardly believe the man had been elected president less than a year ago.
"Well, I thought maybe you could use the $200, that's all."
"Why are they paying so much?" Andy asked suspiciously.
Quincy threw up his hands. "Andy, it is the government's treat. Can't you follow that? 2 years ago, the Shop paid something like $300,000 for a feasibility study on a mass-produced exploding bicycle. And that was in the Sunday Times.
Just another Vietnam thing, I guess, although probably nobody knows for sure. Like Fibber McGee used to say, it seemed like a good idea at the time."
Quincy knocked out his pipe with quick, jittery movements.
To guys like that, every college campus in America is like one big Macy's. They buy a little here, do a little window shopping there. Now, if you don't want it, well, maybe I do. Are you going in on it?
Quincy had to smile. His father ran a chain of extremely successful menswear stores in Ohio and Indiana.
Don't need 200 that bad, he said. Besides, I hate needles.
Oh, look, I'm not trying to sell it, for Christ's sake. You just looked sort of hungry.
Chances are 50-50 you'll be in the control group anyway. 200 bucks for taking on water. Not even tap water, mind you. Distilled water.
You can fix it?
I date one of Wanless's grad assistants, Quincy said. They'll have maybe 50 applications, many of them brown-nosers who want to make points with the mad doctor.
I wish you'd stop calling him that.
Wanless, then, Quincy said, and laughed. He'll see that the apple polishers are weeded out personally. My girl will see that your application goes into his in-basket. After that, dear man, you are on your own.
So he had made out the application when the notice for volunteers went up on the psych department bulletin board. A week after turning it in, a young female GA, Quincy's girlfriend, for all Andy knew, had called on the phone to ask him some questions. He told her that his parents were dead, that his blood type was O, that he had never participated in a psychology department experiment before, that he was indeed currently enrolled in Harrison as an undergraduate class of 69, in fact, and carrying more than the 12 credits needed to classify him as a full-time student. And yes, he was past the age of 21 and legally able to enter into any and all covenants, public and private. A week later, he had received a letter via campus mail telling him he had been accepted and asking for his signature on a release form. Please bring the signed form to room 100, Jason Gearney Hall, on May the 6th. And here he was. Release form passed in. The cigarette-shredding Wanless departed. And he did indeed look a bit like the mad doctor in that Cyclops movie, answering questions about his religious experiences along with 11 other undergrads. Did he have epilepsy? No. His father had died suddenly of a heart attack when Andy was 11. His mother had been killed in a car accident when Andy was 17. A nasty, traumatic thing. His only close family connection was his mother's sister, Aunt Cora, and she was getting well along in years. He went down the column of questions, checking, no, no, no. He checked only one yes question. Have you ever suffered a fracture or serious sprain? If yes, specify. In the space provided, he scribbled the fact that he had broken his left ankle sliding into second base during a Little League game 12 years ago. He went back over his answers, trailing lightly upward with the tip of his Bic. That was when someone tapped him on the shoulder and a girl's voice, sweet and slightly husky, asked, "Could I borrow that if you're done with it? Mine went dry."
"Sure," he said, turning to hand it to her. Pretty girl, tall, light auburn hair, marvelously clear complexion, wearing a powder blue sweater and a short skirt. Good legs. No stockings. Casual appraisal of the future wife.
He handed her his pen and she smiled her thanks. The overhead lights made copper glints in her hair, which had been casually tied back with a wide white ribbon as she bent over her form again. He took his form up to the GA at the front of the room.
"Thank you," the GA said, as programmed as Robbie the Robot. "Room 70, Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Please be on time."
"What's the countersign?" Andy whispered hoarsely. The grad assistant laughed politely.
Andy left the lecture hall, started across the lobby toward the big double doors. Outside, the quad was green with approaching summer, students passing desultorily back and forth, and then remembered his pen. He almost let it go. It was only a 19-cent Bic, and he still had his final round of prelims to study for, but the girl had been pretty, maybe worth chatting up, as the British said. He had no illusions about his looks or his line, which were both pretty nondescript, or about the girl's probable status, pinned or engaged. But it was a nice day, and he was feeling good. He decided to wait. At the very least, he would get another look at those legs. She came out 3 or 4 minutes later, a few notebooks and a text under her arm. She was very pretty indeed, and Andy decided her legs had been worth waiting for. They were more than good. They were spectacular.
"Oh, there you are," she said, smiling.
"Here I am," said Andy McGee. "What did you think of that?"
"I don't know," she said. "My friend said these experiments go on all the time. She was in one last semester with those J.B. Ryan ESP cards and got $50 for it, even though she missed almost all of them. So I just thought..."
She finished the thought with a shrug and flipped her coppery hair neatly back over her shoulders.
"Yeah, me too," he said, taking his pen back.
"Your friend in the psych department?"
"Yes," she said. "And my boyfriend, too. He's in one of Dr. Wanless's classes, so he couldn't get in. Conflict of interest or something."
Boyfriend. It stood to reason that a tall, auburn-haired beauty like this had one. That was the way the world turned.
"What about you?" she asked.
"Same story, friend in the psych department. I'm Andy, by the way, Andy McGee."
"I'm Vicky Tomlinson, and a little nervous about this, Andy McGee. What if I go on a bad trip or something?"
"This sounds like pretty mild stuff to me. And even if it is acid, well, lab acid is different from the stuff you can pick up on the street, or so I've heard. Very smooth, very mellow, and administered under very calm circumstances. They'll probably pipe in cream or Jefferson Airplane," Andy grinned.
"Do you know much about LSD?" she asked, with a little corner-wise grin that he liked very much.
"Very little," he admitted. "I tried it twice, once 2 years ago, once last year. In some ways it made me feel better, it cleaned out my head. At least that's what it felt like. Afterward, a lot of the old crud just seemed to be gone, but I wouldn't want to make a steady habit of it. I don't like feeling so out of control of myself. Can I buy you a Coke?"
"All right," she agreed, and they walked over to the Union Building together. He ended up buying her two Cokes, and they spent the afternoon together. That evening, they had a few beers at the local hangout. It turned out that she and the boyfriend had come to a parting of the ways, and she wasn't sure exactly how to handle it. He was beginning to think they were married, she told Andy, had absolutely forbidden her to take part in the Wanless experiment. For that precise reason, she had gone ahead and signed the release form and was now determined to go through with it, even though she was a little scared. "That Wanless really does look like a mad doctor," she said, making rings on the table with her beer glass. "How did you like that trick with the cigarettes?" Vicky giggled. "Weird way to quit smoking, huh?" He asked her if he could pick her up on the morning of the experiment, and she had agreed gratefully.
"It would be good to go into this with a friend," she said, and looked at him with her direct blue eyes.
"I really am a little scared, you know. George was so, I don't know, adamant."
"Why? What did he say?"
"That's just it," Vicky said. "He wouldn't really tell me anything except that he didn't trust Wanless. He said hardly anyone in the department does, but a lot of them sign up for his tests because he's in charge of the graduate program. Besides, they know it's safe because he just weeds them out again."
He reached across the table and touched her hand. "We'll both probably get the distilled water anyway," he said. "Take it easy, kiddo. Everything's fine." But as it turned out, nothing was fine. Nothing. Three.
"Albany. Albany Airport, mister. Hey, mister, this is it. We're here."
Hand shaking him, making his head roll on his neck. Terrible headache. Jesus, thudding, shooting pains.
"Hey, mister, this is the airport."
Andy opened his eyes, then shut them against the white light of an overhead sodium lamp. There was a terrible shrieking whine building up and up and up, and he winced against it. It felt as if steel darning needles were being jammed into his ears. Plane, taking off. It began to come to him through the red fog of pain. "Ah, yes, Doc, it all comes back to me now.
Mister?"
The cabbie sounded worried.
"Mister, you okay?"
"A headache." His voice seemed to come from far away, buried in the jet engine sound that was mercifully beginning to fade off. "What time is it?"
"Nearly midnight. Slow haul getting up here." "Don't tell me, I'll tell you. Buses won't be running if that was your plan. Sure I can't take you home?"
Andy groped in his mind for the story he had told the cabbie. It was important that he remember, monster headache or not, because of the echo. If he contradicted the earlier story in any way, it could set up a ricochet effect in the cabbie's mind. It might die out, in fact, probably would, but it might not. The cabbie might seize on one point of it, develop a fixation on it. Shortly, it would be out of control. It would be all the cabbie could think about. Shortly after that, it would simply tear his mind apart. It had happened before.
"My car's in the lot," he said. "Everything's under control."
"Oh," the cabbie smiled, relieved.
"Clint isn't going to believe this, you know. Hey, don't tell me. I'll..."
"Sure, she'll believe it. You do, don't you?" The driver grinned widely.
"I got the big bill to prove it, mister. Thanks."
"Thank you," Andy said. struggle to be polite, struggle to go on for Charlie. If he had been alone, he would have killed himself long ago. A man wasn't meant to bear pain like this.
You sure you're okay, mister? You look awful white.
I'm fine. Thanks. He began to shake Charlie.
Hey, kid.
He was careful not to use her name. It probably didn't matter, but the caution came as naturally as breathing.
Wake up. We're here.
Charlie muttered and tried to roll away from him.
Come on, doll. Wake up, hon.
Charlie's eyes fluttered open, the direct blue eyes she had got from her mother, and she sat up, rubbing her face.
Daddy, where are we?
Albany, hon, the airport. And leaning closer, he muttered, don't say anything yet.
Okay.
She smiled at the cab driver, and the cabbie smiled back. She slipped out of the cab, and Andy followed her, trying not to stagger.
Thanks again, man, the cabbie called. Listen, hey, great fare. Don't tell me, I'll tell you.
Andy shook the outstretched hand. Take care.
I will. Glenn's just not gonna believe this action.
The cabbie got back in and pulled away from the yellow-painted curb. Another jet was taking off, the engine revving and revving until Andy felt as though his head would split in two pieces and fall to the pavement like a hollow gourd. He staggered a little, and Charlie put her hands on his arm.
Oh, Daddy, she said, and her voice was far away.
Inside, I have to sit down. They went in, the little girl in the red pants and the green blouse, the big man with the shaggy black hair and the slumped shoulders. A skycap watched them go and thought it was a pure sin, a big man like that out after midnight, drunk as a lord by the look of him, with his little girl, who should have been in bed hours ago, leading him around like a seeing-eye dog. Parents like that ought to be sterilized, the skycap thought. Then they went in through the electric eye-controlled doors, and the skycap forgot all about them until some 40 minutes later, when the green car pulled up to the curb and the two men got out to talk to him.
4. It was 10 past midnight. The lobby of the terminal had been given over to the early morning people. Servicemen at the end of their leaves, harried-looking women riding herd on scratchy up-too-late children, businessmen with pouches of weariness under their eyes, cruising kids in big boots and long hair, some of them with packs on their backs, a couple with cased tennis rackets. The loudspeaker system announced arrivals and departures and paged people like some omnipotent voice in a dream. Andy and Charlie sat side by side at desks with TVs bolted to them. The TVs were scratched and dented and painted dead black. To Andy, they looked like sinister futuristic cobras. He plugged his last two quarters into them so they wouldn't be asked to leave the seats. Charlie's was showing a rerun of The Rookies, and Johnny Carson was yucking it up with Sonny Bono and Buddy Hackett on Andy's.
"Daddy, do I have to?" Charlie asked for the second time.
She was on the verge of tears.
"Honey, I'm used up," he said. "We have no money. We can't stay here." "Those bad men are coming?" she asked, and her voice dropped to a whisper.
"I don't know." Thud, thud, thud in his brain. Not a riderless black horse anymore. Now it was mail sacks filled with sharp scraps of iron being dropped on him from a fifth-story window. "We have to assume they are."
"How could I get money?"
He hesitated and then said, "You know." The tears began to come and trickle down her cheeks.
"It's not right. It's not right to steal."
"I know it," he said, "but it's not right for them to keep coming at us either. I explained it to you, Charlie, or at least I tried."
"About little bad and big bad?"
"Yes, lesser and greater evil."
"Does your head really hurt?"
"It's pretty bad," Andy said. There was no use telling her that in an hour, or possibly two, it would be so bad he would no longer be able to think coherently. No use frightening her worse than she already was. No use telling her that he didn't think they were going to get away this time.
"I'll try," she said, and got out of the chair. "Poor Daddy," she said, and kissed him.
He closed his eyes. The TV played on in front of him, a faraway babble of sound in the midst of the steadily growing ache in his head. When he opened his eyes again, she was just a distant figure, very small, dressed in red and green, like a Christmas ornament, bobbing away through the scattered people on the concourse.
"Please, God, let her be all right," he thought.
"Don't let anyone mess with her or scare her worse than she is already, please. And thank you, God, okay?" He closed his eyes again.
5.
Little girl in red stretch pants and a green rayon blouse. Shoulder-length blonde hair. Up too late, apparently by herself. She was in one of the few places where a little girl by herself could go unremarked after midnight. She passed people, but no one really saw her. If she had been crying, a security guard might have come over to ask her if she was lost, if she knew which airline her mommy and daddy were ticketed on, what their names were so they could be paged. But she wasn't crying, and she looked as if she knew where she was going. She didn't exactly, but she had a pretty fair idea of what she was looking for. They needed money. That was what Daddy had said. The bad men were coming, and Daddy was hurt. When he got hurt like this, it got hard for him to think. He had to lie down and have as much quiet as he could. He had to sleep until the pain went away, and the bad men might be coming, the men from the shop, the men who wanted to pick them apart and see what made them work, and to see if they could be used, made to do things. She saw a paper shopping bag sticking out of the top of a trash basket and took it. A little way farther down the concourse, she came to what she was looking for, a bank of payphones. Charlie stood looking at them, and she was afraid. She was afraid because Daddy had told her again and again that she shouldn't do it. Since earliest childhood, it had been the bad thing. She couldn't always control the bad thing. She might hurt herself, or someone else, or lots of people. The time... Oh, Mommy, I'm sorry. The hurt, the bandages, the scream. She screamed. I made Mommy scream, and I never will again. Never, because it is a bad thing. In the kitchen, when she was little... But it hurt too much to think of that. It was a bad thing because when you let it go, it went everywhere. And that was scary. There were other things. The push, for instance. That's what Daddy called it. The push. Only she could push a lot harder than Daddy, and she never got headaches afterward. But sometimes, afterward, there were fires. The word for the bad thing clanged in her mind as she stood nervously looking at the telephone booths. Pyrokinesis. Never mind that, Daddy had told her when they were still in Port City and thinking like fools that they were safe. You're a fire starter, honey, just one great big Zippo lighter. And then it had seemed funny. She had giggled, but now it didn't seem funny at all. The other reason she wasn't supposed to push was because they might find out. The bad men from the shop. I don't know how much they know about you now, Daddy had told her, but I don't want them to find out any more. Your push isn't exactly like mine, honey. You can't make people, well, change their minds, can you? No, but you can make things move. And if they ever began to see a pattern and connect that pattern to you, we'd be in even worse trouble than we are now. And it was stealing, and stealing was also a bad thing. Never mind, Daddy's head was hurting him, and they had to get to a quiet, warm place before it got too bad for him to think at all. Charlie moved forward. There were about 15 phone booths in all, with circular sliding doors. When you were inside the booth, it was like being inside a great big contact capsule with a phone inside it. Most of the booths were dark, Charlie saw as she drifted down past them. There was a fat lady in a pantsuit crammed into one of them, talking busily and smiling, and three booths from the end a young man in a service uniform was sitting on the little stool with the door open and his legs poking out. He was talking fast.
Sally, look, I understand how you feel, but I can explain everything. Absolutely. I know, but if you'll just let me...
He looked up, saw the little girl looking at him, and yanked his legs in and pulled the circular door closed, all in one motion, like a turtle pulling into its shell. Having a fight with his girlfriend, Charlie thought, probably stood her up. I'd never let a guy stand me up. Echoing loudspeaker, rat of fear in the back of her mind, gnawing. All the faces were strange faces. She felt lonely and very small, grief-sick over her mother, even now. This was stealing, but what did that matter? They had stolen her mother's life. She slipped into the phone booth on the end, shopping bag crackling. She took the phone off the hook and pretended she was talking. "Hello, Grandpa, yes, Daddy and I just got in. We're fine." And looked out through the glass to see if anyone was being nosy. No one was. The only person nearby was a black woman getting flight insurance from a machine, and her back was to Charlie. Charlie looked at the payphone and suddenly shoved it. A little grunt of effort escaped her, and she bit down on her lower lip, liking the way it squeezed under her teeth. No, there was no pain involved. It felt good to shove things, and that was another thing that scared her. Suppose she got to like this dangerous thing. She shoved the payphone again very lightly, and suddenly a tide of silver poured out of the coin return. She tried to get her bag under it, but by the time she did, most of the quarters and nickels and dimes had spewed onto the floor. She bent over and swept as much as she could into the bag, glancing again and again out the window. With the change picked up, she went on to the next booth. The serviceman was still talking on the next phone up the line. He had opened the door again and was smoking.
"Sal, honest to Christ, I did. Just ask your brother if you don't believe me. He'll..."
Charlie slipped the door shut, cutting off the slightly whining sound of his voice. She was only 7, but she knew a snow job when she heard one. She looked at the phone, and a moment later, it gave up its change. This time she had the bag positioned perfectly, and the coins cascaded to the bottom with a musical little jingling sound. The serviceman was gone when she came out, and Charlie went into his booth. The seat was still warm, and the air smelled nastily of cigarette smoke in spite of the fan. The money rattled into her bag, and she went on. Six. Eddie Delgado sat in a hard plastic contour chair, looking up at the ceiling and smoking. Bitch, he was thinking. She'll think twice about keeping her goddamn legs closed next time. Eddie this, and Eddie that, and Eddie, I never want to see you again, and Eddie, how could you be so cruel? But he had changed her mind about the old I never want to see you again bit. He was on 30-day leave, and now he was going to New York City, the Big Apple, to see the sights and tour the singles bars. And when he came back, Sally would be like a big ripe apple herself, ripe and ready to fall. None of that "don't you have any respect for me" stuff went down with Eddie Delgado of Marathon, Florida. Sally Bradford was going to put out, and if she really believed that crap about him having had a vasectomy, it served her right. And then let her go running to her hick schoolteacher brother if she wanted to. Eddie Delgado would be driving an army supply truck in West Berlin. He would be... Eddie's half-resentful, half-pleasant chain of daydreams was broken by a strange feeling of warmth coming from his feet. It was as if the floor had suddenly heated up 10 degrees, and accompanying this was a strange but not completely unfamiliar smell. Not something burning, but something singeing, maybe? He opened his eyes, and the first thing he saw was that little girl who had been cruising around by the phone booths. Little girl, 7 or 8 years old, looking really ragged out. Now she was carrying a big paper bag, carrying it by the bottom as if it were full of groceries or something. But his feet, that was the thing. They were no longer warm. They were hot. Eddie Delgado looked down and screamed, "God almighty Jesus!" His shoes were on fire. Eddie leaped to his feet, heads turned. Some woman saw what was happening and yelled in alarm. 2 security guards who had been noodling with an Allegheny Airlines ticket clerk looked over to see what was going on. None of which meant doodly squat to Eddie Delgado. Thoughts of Sally Bradford and his revenge of love upon her were the furthest things from his mind. His army-issue shoes were burning merrily. The cuffs of his dress greens were catching. He was sprinting across the concourse, trailing smoke as if shot from a catapult. The women's room was closer, and Eddie, whose sense of self-preservation was exquisitely defined, hit the door straight arm and ran inside without a moment's hesitation. A young woman was coming out of one of the stalls, her skirt rucked up to her waist, adjusting her underalls. She saw Eddie, the human torch, and let out a scream that the bathroom's tiled walls magnified enormously. There was a babble of, "What was that?" and "What's going on?" from the few other occupied stalls. Eddie caught the pay toilet door before it could swing back all the way and latch. He grabbed both sides of the stall at the top and hoisted himself feet first into the toilet. There was a hissing sound and a remarkable billow of steam. The 2 security guards burst in. "Hold it, you in there," one of them cried. He had drawn his gun. "Come out of there with your hands laced on top of your head." "You mind waiting until I put my feet out?" Eddie Delgado snarled. 7. Charlie was back, and she was crying again.
"What happened, babe?"
"I got the money, but it got away from me again, Daddy. There was a man, a soldier. I couldn't help it."
Andy felt the fear creep up on him. It was muted by the pain in his head and down the back of his neck, but it was there.
Was there a fire, Charlie?
She couldn't speak, but nodded. Tears coursed down her cheeks. "Oh, my God," Andy whispered, and made himself get to his feet. That broke Charlie completely. She put her face in her hands and sobbed helplessly, rocking back and forth. A knot of people had gathered around the door of the women's room. It had been propped open, but Andy couldn't see. And then he could. The two security guards who had gone running down there were leading a tough-looking young man in an army uniform out of the bathroom and toward the security office. The young man was jawing at them loudly, and most of what he had to say was inventively profane. His uniform was mostly gone below the knees, and he was carrying two dripping blackened things that might once have been shoes. Then they were gone into the office, the door slamming behind them. An excited babble of conversation swept the terminal. Andy sat down again and put his arm around Charlie. It was very hard to think now. His thoughts were tiny silverfish swimming around in a great black sea of throbbing pain. But he had to do the best he could. He needed Charlie if they were going to get out of this. "He's all right, Charlie. He's okay. They just took him down to the security office. Now, what happened?" Through diminishing tears, Charlie told him, overhearing the soldier on the phone, having a few random thoughts about him, a feeling that he was trying to trick the girl he was talking to. "And then, when I was coming back to you, I saw him. And before I could stop it, it happened. It just got away. I could have hurt him, Daddy. I could have hurt him bad. I set him on fire."
"Keep your voice down," he said. "I want you to listen to me, Charlie. I think this is the most encouraging thing that's happened in some time."
You do?"
She looked at him in frank surprise.
"You say it got away from you," Andy said, forcing the words.
"And it did, but not like before. It only got away a little bit.
What happened was dangerous, honey, but you might have set his hair on fire or his face."
She winced away from that thought, horrified. Andy turned her face gently back to his.
"It's a subconscious thing, and it always goes out at someone you don't like," he said. "But you didn't really hurt that guy, Charlie. You..."
But the rest of it was gone, and only the pain was left. Was he still talking? For a moment, he didn't even know. Charlie could still feel that thing, that bad thing, racing around in her head, wanting to get away again, to do something else. It was like a small, vicious, and rather stupid animal. You had to let it out of its cage to do something like getting money from the phones, but it could do something else, something really bad. Like Mommy in the kitchen, "Oh, Mom, I'm sorry," before you could get it back in again. But now it didn't matter. She wouldn't think about it now. She wouldn't think about the bandages. "My mommy has to wear bandages because I hurt her." Any of it now. Her father was what mattered now. He was slumped over in his TV chair, his face stamped with pain. He was paper white. His eyes were bloodshot.
"Oh, Daddy," she thought, "I'd trade even Stephen with you if I could. You've got something that hurts you, but it never gets out of its cage. I've got something big that doesn't hurt me at all, but, oh, sometimes I get so scared." "I've got the money," she said. "I didn't go to all the telephones because the bag was getting heavy and I was afraid it would break."
She looked at him anxiously.
"Where can we go, Daddy? You have to lie down."
Andy reached into the bag and slowly began to transfer the change in handfuls to the pockets of his corduroy coat. He wondered if this night would ever end. He wanted to do nothing more than grab another cab and go into town and check them into the first hotel or motel in sight, but he was afraid. Cabs could be traced, and he had a strong feeling that the people from the green car were still close behind. He tried to put together what he knew about the Albany airport. First of all, it was the Albany County Airport. It really wasn't in Albany at all, but in the town of Colony. Shaker Country. Hadn't his grandfather told him once that this was Shaker Country? Or had all of them died out now? What about highways? Turnpikes? The answer came slowly. There was a road, some sort of way, north way or south way, he thought. He opened his eyes and looked at Charlie. "Can you walk a ways, kiddo? Couple of miles, maybe?"
"Sure."
She had slept and felt relatively fresh.
"Can you?"
That was the question. He didn't know. "I'm going to try," he said. "I think we ought to walk out to the main road and try to catch a ride, hon."
"Hitchhike?" she asked.
He nodded. "Tracing a hitchhiker is pretty hard, Charlie. If we're lucky, we'll get a ride with someone who'll be in Buffalo by morning. And if we're not, we'll still be standing in the breakdown lane with our thumbs out when that green car comes rolling up."
"If you think it's okay,"
Charlie said doubtfully. "Come on," he said, "help me." gigantic bolt of pain as he got to his feet. He swayed a little, closed his eyes, then opened them again. People looked surreal. Colors seemed too bright. A woman walked by on high heels, and every click on the airport tiles was the sound of a vault door being slammed. "Daddy, are you sure you can?" Her voice was small and very scared. "Charlie. Only Charlie looked right. I think I can," he said. "Come on." They left by a different door from the one they had entered, and the skycap who had noticed them getting out of the cab was busy unloading suitcases from the trunk of a car. He didn't see them go out.
"Which way, Daddy?"
Charlie asked. He looked both ways and saw the north way, curving away below and to the right of the terminal building. How to get there, that was the question. There were roads everywhere, overpasses, underpasses, no right turn, stop on signal, keep left, no parking any time. Traffic signals flashing in the early morning blackness like uneasy spirits. "This way, I think," he said, and they walked the length of the terminal beside the feeder road that was lined with loading and unloading only signs. The sidewalk ended at the end of the terminal. A large silver Mercedes swept by them indifferently, and the reflected glow of the overhead sodium arcs on its surface made him wince. Charlie was looking at him questioningly. Andy nodded. "Just keep as far over to the side as you can. Are you cold?"
"No, Daddy."
"Thank goodness it's a warm night. Your mother would..." His mouth snapped shut over that. The two of them walked off into darkness. The big man with the broad shoulders and the little girl in the red pants and the green blouse holding his hand, almost seeming to lead him. Eight. The green car showed up about 15 minutes later and parked at the yellow curb. Two men got out, the same two who had chased Andy and Charlie to the cab back in Manhattan. The driver sat behind the wheel. An airport cop strolled up. "You can't park here, sir," he said. "If you just pull up to..." "Sure I can," the driver said. He showed the cop his ID. The airport cop looked at it, looked at the driver, looked back at the picture on the ID. "Oh," he said, "I'm sorry, sir. Is it something we should know about?" "Nothing that affects airport security," the driver said, "but maybe you can help. Have you seen either of these two people tonight?" He handed the airport cop a picture of Andy and then a fuzzy picture of Charlie. Her hair had been longer then. In the snap, it was braided into pigtails. Her mother had been alive then. "The girl's a year or so older now," the driver said. "Her hair's a bit shorter, about to her shoulders." The cop examined the pictures carefully, shuffling them back and forth. "You know, I believe I did see this little girl," he said. "Towhead, isn't she? Picture makes it a little hard to tell." "Towhead, right. The man her father? Ask me no questions, I'll tell you no lies." The airport cop felt a wave of dislike for the blank-faced young man behind the wheel of the nondescript green car. He had had peripheral doings with the FBI, the CIA, and the outfit they called the Shop before. Their agents were all the same, blankly arrogant and patronizing. They regarded anyone in a blue suit as a kiddie cop. But when they had the hijacking here 5 years ago, it had been the kiddie cops who got the guy, loaded down with grenades, off the plane, and he had been in the custody of the real cops when he committed suicide by opening up his carotid artery with his own fingernails. Nice going, guys. "Look, sir, I asked if the man was her father to try and find out if there's a family resemblance. Those pictures make it a little hard to tell. They look a bit alike, different hair colors." "That much I could see for myself, you asshole," the airport cop thought. "I saw them both," the cop told the driver of the green car. "He's a big guy, bigger than he looks in that picture. He looked sick or something." "Did he?" The driver seemed pleased. "We've had a big night here, all told. Some fool also managed to light his own shoes on fire." The driver sat bolt upright behind the wheel. "Say what?" The airport cop nodded, happy to have got through the driver's bored facade. He would not have been so happy if the driver had told him he had just earned himself a debriefing in the Shop's Manhattan offices. And Eddie Delgado probably would have beaten the crap out of him, because instead of touring the singles bars and the massage parlors and the Times Square porno shops during the Big Apple segment of his leave, he was going to spend most of it in a drug-induced state of total recall, describing over and over again what had happened before and just after his shoes got hot. 9. The other two men from the green sedan were talking to airport personnel.
One of them discovered the skycap who had noticed Andy and Charlie getting out of the cab and going into the terminal.
"Sure I saw them. I thought it was a purity shame, a man as drunk as that having a little girl out that late."
"Maybe they took a plane," one of the men suggested.
"Maybe so," the skycap agreed. "I wonder what that child's mother can be thinking of. I wonder if she knows what